Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Do you want to know more about the common barriers for fathers and stepfathers as it relates to their daughters and what to do about it? Joe Kelly is here with us today, and he has researched and written about the power and potential of father-daughter relationships since 1992. He is an advocate, educator, and family coach for Within Health. He wrote the best-selling books, Dads and Daughters, How to Inspire, Understand, and Support Your Daughter, and The Complete Idiot's Guide to Being a New Dad. His 11 other books include 4 on eating disorders. Joe and his spouse, Nancy Groover, founded the girl-edited feminist magazine, New Moon Girls. A past president of the Minnesota Fathers and Families Network, Joe has twin adult daughters and 3 grandsons. Joe, thank you for being here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
It's so nice to see you.
Yeah, it's wonderful to see you too.
Joe, I thought we'd start off with a question about how are we defining father?
Well, I tend to take a pretty broad approach to defining fathers and other what I call male loved ones who influence us. When it comes to fathers, of course, there's the traditional biological father, so stepfathers, and a lot of times children will have multiple stepfathers. There are social fathers, which is a term of art in the fatherhood field, which is adult males who have some influence in a child's life. Might be temporary or not nearly as intense as a live-with father, but, still an influence. And so I like to think of it in terms of care. All of us are surrounded by circles of care. And those circles are wider and more populated than we usually think of them being. Those circles go beyond our immediate family. They go beyond our extended families. And so I think of fatherhood in that context.
I have never heard the term social father. Mm-hmm. I love it. The term that I usually use, but I may change that, is friend family. So the father's in our friend family. Mm-hmm. And we have some incredible ones. I'm so grateful for the social fathers in our lives.
And I think, I think language is really important. Social fathers are, for example, one of our children's best friends growing up was a girl about 2 years older than them who lived across the street with her parents. And Robert, her father, was a social father to my kids. And I was a social father to Robert's daughter, Sarah. And it just was natural. We didn't have to name it that or, make any arrangements. It just was. And in the same way, I think it's really important to completely do away with terms like custodial father or custodial parent because, I have custody of this bottle of water right here, this object. Children are not property. So I like the term that my friend Bill Clatty came up with is live with dad and live away dad. Mm. It's descriptive, has no judgment, and opens us up the idea that they both have really essential influences in the life of children.
And I'm just now thinking of the social fathers I had in my formative years and what an imprint they had, especially given the time of life and how emotionally rich that time of life is.
Yeah.
And I can remember one that's not with us now, but I'll never forget his presence and just the way he cared for me. And social fathers, it makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. And Joe, Why fathers and daughters? Why not fathers and all children, regardless of gender?
Well, because I have daughters.
I wondered if you might answer that way.
That's why I...
That's your lived experience.
It's my lived experience. And that lived experience motivated me to begin talking with many other fathers who had daughters. And of course, miracle of miracles, a lot of those fathers also have sons. And even more amazing, every single one of those fathers, like me, grew up as a boy.
Oh, that's a good point.
So what I found is in talking about and thinking about and writing about and speaking about this, when talking about father-daughter relationships, we really end up talking a whole lot about maleness and male acculturation in our society and the price we pay for it and the advantages it provides us and the challenges it gives us. And I think there are, talking about it through the lens of father-daughter relationships can reveal a lot about that.
One of the topics that you speak about often is the common barriers for fathers and for stepfathers. What are some of those common barriers?
Well, I think that both the barrier and the wonderful potential that comes first is I grew up a boy. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's like to grow up a girl. And there are differences. They're not predetermined, but they just are differences, most of it related to acculturation of boys and girls, men and women. So there's things that are going to take more effort on our part as fathers to get and to respond to. You know, another really major barrier is fear.
Mm.
I believe a lot of fathers in this country have a huge fear of their daughters' emerging sexuality.
Mm.
And that they have that fear from the day their daughter is born. You know, numerous fathers have, when I've asked them about, what do you remember about the day your daughter was born? A very common answer is, I looked at her and thought, nobody's going to date her until she's 35.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I mean, I don't know why I would, but I didn't realize that that is on their mind as early as when they're born. And I know, you know, we're all kind of familiar, of course, with that, like, dad with a shotgun on the front porch parable. And my dad, he always threatened to greet my dates with a samurai sword because he's a black belt in a lot of things.
Yeah.
I think he actually did one time. But so what is that? Can you say more?
I think it's a visceral fear that is revealed to us. Our vulnerability to it is revealed when we have a female child.
Mm.
And you know, the samurai sword or the shotgun on the front porch when my daughter is an adolescent, that fear begins when my daughter is born.
Mm.
So it's been there and it's visceral for many, many years. And I think of, you know, the first time somebody, you know, comes calling on my daughter, I'm going to be out on the front porch carrying my shotgun because I want him to know that I know what he's after. And I want him to know that I know it, and I'm not going to let him get away with it, is, I think of it as a parable because I think it has really important, because, well, first of all, it's a really common story.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people recognize it immediately and have experienced it. And it's a parable because it has important lessons that it conveys for the three characters in the story. You know, the lesson it conveys to my daughter is, Daddy doesn't trust you. As he doesn't trust your choice in friends, doesn't trust that you're able to take care of yourself, and that you have judgment and discernment. What it says to the boy is, here I am, a man representing what it means to be a man in my community, and I'm not going to see you as a person. I'm going to see you as a perp.
Mm.
And I'm going to see you totally as a threat and a danger, and that all you want is sex. The lesson for the dad is, we're terrified. We're terrified that our daughter might be harmed or violated in a way that we can't fix. or that we can't prevent. And what I take from that is we fathers are missing the point when we go down that road, because the problem is not the boy coming up the front step. The problem is a culture that celebrates violence against women, that builds, you know, mass market blockbuster movies on rape and kidnapping of women. So the problem is the culture, and the solution is not the shotgun. The solution is to get my ass off the front porch, out into the culture where, sadly, I have more influence than females do, to try and change it so that it's better and safer and more nurturing for our daughters, which will then make it more nurturing for our sons.
I see.
It's not an either or. And that sort of thing opens me up to recognizing this boy coming up the front step, and this, I know this is, you know, a heterosexual model, but same things apply regardless of that, that he and I have something very important in common. We both like my daughter.
What a nice reframe.
And can I trust that? Can I trust myself to trust that? And knowing that, yeah, not every boy who comes up the front step is going to end up being my son-in-law.
Right. You know,
that's okay. And to be reflecting on what was my experience at that age. And I remember Dad telling me that he was a live-away dad, and he said he loved being able to talk to his 12- and 13-year-old daughter about dating and adolescent romance. And he said, I feel like I'm her spy into the world of boyhood.
Oh.
Because I told stories on myself about, oh, God, I had to screw up so much courage to ask Signe to dance at the school hop, you know. And, I mean, I'm dating myself here, but, you know, or, oh, I was just too timid to even go up and talk to her or whatever. So it's like sharing those stories, that is so helpful to me as the father and to my children and my sons and my daughters to talk about those things, to say, hey, you know, this is a very intense time and you're not the only one who's gone through it. Right. And you're not alone.
When I think of my junior high dances, unfortunately, I have Quiet Riot to share. So I think that your music was probably a little better.
Yeah, it was a lot of Motown. Yeah,
exactly. Mine is still seared in my brain, though. So anyway, so what about adult women and their dads? I've heard you use a term called father hunger.
Yes, and it is a term I have borrowed from and learned almost everything I know about it from Margot Main, who is a wonderful therapist and author. And she wrote a book in the 90s called Father Hunger, Fathers, Daughters, and Food. She's an eating disorders therapist. And I think all of us, in some ways, no matter what age we are, we hunger for things from our parents. And that adult daughters identify some very specific things that they hunger for from their fathers. And some of those hungers are met, some of them are not. Some are met partly, some are not at all. And it's the idea of there's real value, and I've worked with groups of adult women on this, of identifying what am I hungering for from my father, even if my father's dead. What are my hungers? What did I want? Or what do I want from my father? And a lot of times it's as simple as validation, affection, being seen as more than what I look like, and being valued for more than my body shape. It's seeing me as a whole person. And when I identify when women are able to articulate and write down and identify, well, what am I hungering for from my father? Then it's an easy step to say, okay, well, what are the chances I'm going to get that hunger met?
I see. So the first step is being aware of what the hunger is. So that awareness has a chain reaction.
Right.
Then asking, so say for example, it's I'm hungry for validation.
Right.
And then the second step is asking, how likely is it that I'm going to get this validation from my father?
My father or my stepfather. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I, you know, I make my best judgment about that. And then the next step is, okay, where else can I get those hungers met? If not from my father. Mm-hmm. And get them met in healthy ways. And part of what that process reveals is two things. One, the power and potential of the father-daughter relationship. And two, that my father hungers are my hungers. Mm-hmm. They don't belong to my father. They're, you know, my father might have been irresponsible, you know, in how he had his relationship with me. But my hungers now as an adult are my own responsibility. And I have freedom to get them met.
It's a very powerful statement, and I've always loved it because it's like it doesn't need to be a life sentence.
Right.
Right? So,
and it doesn't depend on what my father does or even if he's still alive.
Right. Right. And maybe looking in your social circle, for example, of ways you might seek out validation in other ways, but also how you might give it to yourself.
Yes. You know, and I've heard really wonderful moving stories and one moving, very sad stories from adult women who've gone through this process. But, you know, one of them is, you know, going to their father and for the first time in their lives directly saying, you know, what do you value about me? How has your life changed because I am your child? You know, asking these very direct questions, which are, oddly enough, not questions we often ask one another within a family.
No, we don't.
You know, and this is one of the things that I really challenge fathers to do is to look at how have you been changed as a man because you're a parent? And always men can find something that they can identify about them that's changed. And then I challenge them, how many of you have ever heard your own father tell you how he was changed as a man because you are his son? And it's very rare for a man to say, I've had that conversation. And then the very small number of people who have had that conversation, almost all of them had it when their father was dying.
My mind was already there.
Yeah.
It's just a knowing that we have. I don't know why that, I mean, I...
And I think it's a really tragic representation of generational cycles of silence mm-hmm. among men and between mm-hmm. men and the price of sexism and male acculturation in this country. And it keeps us, you know, fathers in the moment, in the present. It inhibits our willingness or even awareness that it's possible to talk to one another. I have twin daughters. They're both the same age. Am I going to, you know, be a surprise to you, but they are. They're the same age. they're 42. I'm 68. I have 84 years of experience as a father because I have two 42-year-olds. You know, you have how much experience as a mother?
13.
So look at that. We're just the two of us sitting here. Grand total of three children. We're up to a century's worth of experience as parents. Mm-hmm. How often am I asking you to open your encyclopedia of experience? How often are you asking me to open mine? That's the challenge that fathers face.
That is so interesting. And Joe, I think this might be the perfect time to ask you to tell the audience the $5 and $2.50 story.
Well, and this is a story I've heard therapists tell for ages, and it relates to the, you know, getting my hungers met, my needs met from my father. And it's something, you know, if I keep going to my father and say, can you lend me $5? And he keeps saying no. I keep going back and asking him for $5 and he keeps saying no. And I keep going back when in the process, I realize, or maybe he tells me directly, you know, I only got $250. I don't have $5. But I keep asking him for $5. It's like, well, whose problem is that? You know, who's paying the price for that disappointment? I am. If somebody's only got $250 that he or she can give to me, then I need to go find the other $250 somewhere else.
Mm.
You know, that's just the way it is. You know, if I want more validation from my father or my mother and I don't feel like I'm getting it, well, then let me go somewhere else. Let me take and be grateful for and accept whatever validation, if any, I get from my parent, and then let me go to other people, places, and things in my life.
Is it sort of like if you keep chasing the $5 and he only has $250, it sort of feels like chasing a phantom?
That's what it is. I don't know that it feels that way. What it feels like is I'm getting robbed.
Right. I see.
You know?
Right.
But that's not really what's happening. And it's, you know, and it clouds our experience and clouds our recognition of what's actually going on.
Well, I imagine that would be maybe some grief work.
Absolutely.
So it's like, okay, I'm going to grieve the loss of what my father maybe isn't or maybe what I deserved and get on with my life.
Right. And, you know, I think grief is a part of life from very early on.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
As much as we'd like to pretend that it's not.
Not.
You know,
right.
It is.
Yeah. You know, I know my five-year-old grandson, is experiencing grief of not being the only child anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
That's life. Life includes loss.
And I remember something I read from Bob Dietz's work on grief, and he has this later stage of grief called adaptation and renewal. It's like, you know what? Things aren't going to be the same. Yeah. As in, I'm not the only child anymore. They're going to be different, and how am I going to move on from here?
Right. And then like everything else in life, it's a paradox. Grief is a gift.
Right. When we're talking about parents, I also like to kind of think about, like, you might be adaptation and renewal, like a later stage of grief, but because they're parents, like every once in a while, something is going to come up, you know, and you may go up to a higher stage of grief.
Right. Exactly.
You see?
Yeah. And I certainly grieved when my children were becoming adults.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they were the center of my life for, you know, 2 decades or so.
Right.
And naturally, I ceased to be the center of their life.
I'm like, right.
Oh, that's so unfair.
That's sad, Joe, but it's not a grief I'm going to experience because I'm going with Andy. I don't. Yeah, that's.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you say so.
There are lots of other things I'll grieve, but not that one, Joe. Thanks for bringing it up. And Joe, here's another thing I remember about your work, because you and I are going on 10 plus years of knowing each other. And. I remember you telling me this one time that you went and spoke to this very large audience. And I think that this particular audience was all males that we're speaking to. And you asked them, when do they think that they, quote unquote, get over their dad issues?
Well, yeah. And it's interesting that, you know, most of the guys, you know, when they raised their hands and invited their answers, nearly everybody said, well, you know, I'll get over my dad issues when my father dies. And I was able to share a little bit of my story where, you know, my father right now has been dead for many, many years. I still have a relationship with him. And so what I said to these guys is, you know, our father is our father until the day we die. I think it's something that's very important for fathers to realize, that we are our child's father until the day our child dies.
I know that we all know that, but we don't. It's like we don't think of it that way. Or until you told me that story, I had never thought of it that way.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for me, it changes how I think about my relationship with my daughters and even my relationship with my grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's another example. My maternal grandfather is somebody I think about every day. He was without question, the most positive influence in my life growing up. I even adopted my nickname for him to use with my own grandchildren. And I feel like I'm trying to be Beepa, my Beepa. I'm trying to be that Beepa to my grandchildren. They'll never know who he was. My children don't really know who he is or who he was. Who cares? This is part of what makes us human, is our legacies and our memories and our passing on things, paying things forward in ways that cannot be quantified and don't have to be quantified. It's not important that they're quantified. It's important that they are.
Well said. Another lesson I learned from you 10 plus years ago. I was looking at our email threads from about that time. Goodness. I know, because I have an AOL account, so they stay there forever.
Wow. Yeah. You make a good journalist. Right. Do your research.
You taught me how to better engage my clients' male loved ones as allies in treatment and recovery.
Right.
Can you talk to us about why males tend to be untapped resources?
I think for basically two reasons that are rooted in one reason. Coming back, it's male acculturation, how we acculturate men and boys and how we acculturate women and girls. And that, you know, the standard acculturation is that when it comes to relationships in a family, that's women's work. That plays itself out in who takes a child to the doctor, who takes a child to a therapist, who is driving the car, you know? And that stuff matters. The things I learned most about my children when they were in pre-adolescence, I learned when I was driving them and their friends to ballet, and they forgot I was there.
Yeah.
I was just driving the car and I was gathering all this intelligence, like, ooh, hey, this, I didn't know this. You know, so it's like a lot of it is, am I there? If I'm not there, I'm not going to know what's going on. So that's kind of a tangent I went on. Sorry. But we're acculturated to believe and accept that relationship work is women's work, and therapy and more and more all forms of healthcare is an environment that is predominantly made up of women. And so men don't see themselves or think of themselves as allies or resources. And women within families and within healthcare systems don't naturally think of them.
I mean, I'm embarrassed about this, but I was not naturally pulling the male loved ones in. The mom would make the call, the mom and daughter or whoever would come in, and it just would never occur to me to even kind of go outside of the box until you taught me otherwise. Yeah. And ever since then, I've been doing a better job. Mm-hmm. I still have room for improvement around that. Yeah. I can get a little lazy around it, but it really opened my eyes.
And I think it's a practice or a skill that we have to develop.
Right. It has to be very intentional. Because if not, you just sort of subconsciously don't do it.
And the wonderful thing about doing this sort of work with professionals, treatment providers, is that there's a ton of research I can refer to that identifies what are the barriers that inhibit my engaging male loved ones. What are the barriers that inhibit male loved ones from putting themselves in those spaces. And they're really pretty simple to overcome, and they don't cost anything. It's like you don't have to build a facility for this resource.
Right.
They already exist.
And how brilliant that Within Health has you in that role.
It's fascinating to see how it plays out, because the guys who are coming to the male loved ones coaching group that I do for Within Health, they are the treatment providers at Within Health report that these guys are showing up much more than they were before they came to this male coaching group. And all we're coaching them about in the male loved ones group is, you're a resource. Here's how to be a resource. Here are some things you can do that will address your own distress about the behavior of this eating disorder, and ways in which you can practice aligning with the person you love instead of being distracted by the eating disorder.
Yes.
Boy, it just opens the doors. You know, engaging a lot more in family and friend support groups, emailing the treatment providers, showing up for appointments. Mm-hmm. You know, you do the work, you get a pretty concrete results. It's not 100%. Nothing is.
It's so cool because you're giving them a point of reference of how they could be supportive and be an ally in recovery.
And it's helping them recognize that their loved one sees them that way. Because, mm-hmm. you know, you probably have heard this from people who've recovered from eating disorder saying, my family loved me when I couldn't love myself. And I didn't know it at the time that that was important to me, but now it's like, it's so precious. I never would have made it without that.
Exactly.
So getting all family members and all the wide circle of loved ones, male and female and other, to recognize power and potential they have is really valuable.
Joe, I want to thank you for being here today and for the important work you do, giving fathers that point of reference for how to build stronger relationships with their daughters, and for teaching professionals like me how to better engage male loved ones as allies and how to heal father hunger.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I feel incredibly lucky to be doing this work. So thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. We'll see you next month.